I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Ukraine crisis, NATO crisis. The scale is vast. I'm going to go quickly because Professor Stephen F. Cohen is here, New York University, Princeton University, Russian History Emeritus, to comment on the breaking news and also the momentum of these last days. I begin with NATO. Right now, underway in the Black Sea is an iteration of the exercise called Sea Breeze. This is a drill by 11 nations. However, the important thing is the Russian military, the Russian Navy, is keeping tabs on the U.S. Navy. In particular, the guided missile frigate Lodny is Russian. That's Krivak-class Russian guided missile frigate Lodny is following the U.S. guided missile destroyer USS Donald Cook. Since the destroyer Cook entered the Black Sea last week, the exercise is underway. This is a moving story of training off the shores of Ukraine and Georgia, Black Sea Basin. More NATO. There is an exercise planned in October. It's called Trident Juncture 2015. This will be a vast-scale exercise, 36,000 NATO troops, 27 member countries, 7 partner nations participating, 140 aircraft, 60 ships and submarines. So a big push. They're going to be training all across the Russian frontier. The exercise in northern Europe, Norway, the Baltic Sea, and the North Sea. It will extend, of course, farther into Europe, but they're concentrating on the Baltic Sea Basin, where the anxiety is very high. You will recall it's been that way for some months because of the Baltic states, which have Kaliningrad, the Russian enclave, behind them, to the west of them. In addition, there has been conflict over the Baltic Sea Basin all year, over flights and reports of ships, submarines, a lot of anxiety in the Baltic Sea Basin. One more exercise, one more conflict. This isn't a NATO conflict. This has to do with the Arctic Council. There are nations, Russia's one of them, America's one of them, that are part of a council of nations around the Arctic Circle. This is part of the changing story of climate change. Climate change means the prospect of opening sea lanes and access to mineral wealth in the north. The old story is there was such a thing as the Red Arctic in the 1930s, claims by the Stalinist state for the resources of the north. But in those days, there was not easy passage. Now the contest is between the Arctic states, the Arctic Council, and Russia for claims of mineral resources. At the same time, there's anxiety about Russia flying air patrols and with its icebreaker fleet, which is very large in comparison to the U.S. U.S. has one icebreaker. Russia has dozens across the Arctic Circle. Because of this, there are voices calling this the new ice curtain. All right, we move from the NATO and national conflict to the stories in Ukraine. Within these last days, Poroshenko, the president of Ukraine, has been on the phone with Joe Biden, the vice president of the United States, who is importantly now being entertained as a presidential contender in 2016. That call was to support Poroshenko in his resistance to Russian aggression, so-called. This is the Donbass front. And also to say that the vice president is standing with the Ukraine resistance to those who would pull Ukraine apart. You will recall the vice president has been much involved in Ukraine's success since 2012, but you could say reaching back to 2008, because the Black Sea Basin, that's what we're really talking about, has been in conflict since the breakdown in relations between Moscow and Tbilisi, Georgia, in 2008. Also, a phone call between 3 members of the Normandy Four. You will recall that Mr. Poroshenko, a week ago, traveled to Berlin to sit with Hollande of France and Merkel of Berlin. Steve and I talked about that meeting and what could come of it. Well, what happened is that a week later, Hollande of France and Merkel of Berlin were on the phone call with Vladimir Putin, the 4th member of the Normandy Four, very much insisting that the Minsk II mandate goes forward. This is from last February, the meeting of the Normandy Four, arranging for elections and a resolution of the Ukraine conflict by the end of 2015, chiefly recognizing the special status of Donbass, that part, eastern part of the country that's been in conflict and most damaged by the civil war. One more detail about these phone calls. We're also told that Mr. Poroshenko and Merkel, Ms. Merkel and Mr. Hollande and Vladimir Putin all agreed upon a September 1st ceasefire along the Donbass frontier. The good news is that looks to have happened. The OSCE, which is the monitoring referee of the civil war, is reporting in these last hours that there's a marked decrease in the amount of gunfire along the Donbass front. There have been provocations of artillery fire for some 2 weeks now, with many casualties. No casualties reported in the last 12 hours. That needs to be updated because this is a moving story. But in any event, the OSCE was pointing to a decrease in violence. At the same time, and this is the good news of the week, the September 1st opening of schools in Russia is also the opening of schools in Ukraine. And in the Donetsk People's Republic, the DPR, and the Luhansk People's Republic, the LPR, the OSCE is reporting that the schools are open and the students are attending. So that is certainly a strong indication that things are returning, at least if not to normal, then less violently. Now we turn to the hard news, and this is the part where I'm going to ask the professor to speak at length. Within these last hours, we learn a third Ukrainian policeman is dead of his injuries. This comes from a street battle in Kiev. The contestants are a moving story, but there are 140 people in hospital injured in the battle. There was a hand grenade reported, but in war, the first three reports are wrong. So I'm just going to go to the report that I had from the OSCE. This is the referees, the special monitoring mission, about what happened in Kiev outside the Rada, the parliamentary building in Kiev. The OSCE is reporting at 900 hours. This is August 31st, Ukraine time, 2015. 3,000 persons, male and female, carrying Svoboda Party, that's associated with the right wing, Radical Party, not identified, and Ukrop Party flags were protesting the constitutional amendments that were being voted on inside the parliament. Riot police, 1,000 of them showed up, and National Guards, 1,000 of them showed up with anti-riot equipment. Approximately 1,300 hours, in other words, 4 hours later, according to the OSCE, this isn't either the Russian side or the Ukraine side. This is the monitors who are paid to risk their lives to be there. The protesters, growing agitated, learned the constitutional amendments that had been passed in the first reading. There was burning of debris around the main entrance. There was confrontation with servicemen. There were verbal and physical confrontations. There was a cordon built of anti-riot gear. And then approximately 15 minutes later, the observation of tear gas canisters being thrown. At 1345 hours, there was a very loud explosion, a grenade explosion, the monitoring unit is reporting. And now there were originally reported 120 servicemen were injured. I've given you the update now. The third policeman has died. Professor, I will end there because a week ago and 2 weeks ago, you pointed to a conflict that could be a new civil war. I don't know if this counts as a civil war, Steve, but as the gunfire stops on the Donbass front, the violence begins in Kiev. I will not say good evening to you. I will say, where are we going in Kiev, Steve? We'll start there. Good evening.
I don't want to lose the human dimension because all of our discussion of leaders trying to solve this issue or leaders who don't want peace but want war, at stake are thousands and thousands, if not millions, of human lives. It's possible that the various parties agreed to a new ceasefire on September 1 because, as you pointed out, that is the traditional first day of school in Russia and in all Slavic regions, including eastern Ukraine. And it's an exceptionally moving, beautiful ceremony, this first day of school. It's always September 1. People come back from summer vacation. They dress their young children in their finest clothes. The kids all bring flowers to their teachers. Not much teaching goes on the first day because the parents come too. It's a very ceremonial, I would say, almost sacred ritual, this first day of school. So for the leaders of the involved powers to choose September 1 for a ceasefire has a symbolism. And there are these reports, as you say, that a lot of kids went to school today in eastern Ukraine. But ask yourself, and all of our listeners should ask themselves, if you were a parent living in Lugansk or in Donetsk, these big capital cities of Donbass, which have been under almost constant fire until recently by Kiev's army, would you have sent your children to school today? Because the bombardment of the cities has been capricious. I would not say they've targeted schools, but kindergartens, schools, hospitals have been struck repeatedly. And so each parent in those areas had to make a decision today, yesterday, Donbass time, I think it's 7 or 8 hours earlier. Will I take my children, send my children to school today? A lot decided to do so, but it would be interesting how many decided not, because that's what's at stake here. What's happened yesterday, Monday, on the square in front of the Kiev Parliament, the Rada, may be the beginning of the end of what Russia calls, and I think not unreasonably, Washington's Maidan project. It's Ukrainian project designed to remove Ukraine, the entirety of Ukraine if possible, though Russia has already taken back Crimea. So Crimea is now part of Russia. But to take bring the remaining part of Ukraine into the Western sphere of influence, either as an actual member of NATO, as a member of the European Union, or as what is increasingly looking to be a kind of American colony, because so many Americans are on the ground, some of them quiet Americans, not in uniforms, some in boots. This ultra right wing, some of these people are fascist, opposition to the purportedly moderate government that we have backed in Kiev. And the issue, as you know, John, and as our listeners will remember, the issue is larger than this, but comes down to one thing. The Minsk agreements, which Germany, France, Russia, and Ukraine agreed to, require a special status for the rebel provinces in Donbass, Donetsk, and Lugansk, a high degree of home rule, not independence, not separatism. But they are to be given the right to run their own internal affairs, elect their own mayor, their own governor, to decide which language they speak, Ukrainian or Russian, to keep a high degree of their taxation revenue at home, not send. Traditionally, Kiev has taken about almost 85% of revenue, tax revenue, back to Kiev from these regions. The regions are starved for funds. So Poroshenko, the president of Ukraine, agreed to a special law that would give these regions special status, special form of home rule, and in return, these regions would not leave Ukraine. They would remain part of Ukraine.
Just a minute, therefore, Steve. We'll continue. Professor Stephen F. Cohen setting up what we're going to discuss at length tonight, the violence in Kiev. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. I interrupted my colleague, Professor Stephen F. Cohen, New York University, Princeton University, Russian History Emeritus, as we were discussing the terms of Minsk II and what is presented as the predicate for violence observed in Kiev in these last 24 hours. The third Ukrainian policeman is now reported to have died of his injuries. There are 140 reported wounded and in hospitals in a confrontation between Svoboda, that's a right-wing party, and other radical elements, and the Ukrainian National Guard and the Ukrainian police. Steve, forgive me for interrupting. You were speaking of the formula in exchange for agreeing to the special status of Donbass. There was to be a general understanding that Ukraine would return to normalcy and beginning the rebuild. So the violence in front of Kiev, it looks to be people who do not want normalcy. They want victory. In which way, Steve?
They completely reject these ultra-right-wing nationalist movements, and there are many of them. The two best known are the Svoboda Party, which is in the parliament, and the paramilitary and substantially neo-fascist movement known as Right Sector, which has its own military battalion fighting in the east, and which has threatened Poroshenko, the president, to remove him if he went ahead and gave Donbass the special status. Their view is that would be betrayal, and the people on the square protesting on money shouted the word betrayal at Poroshenko, at the parliament, at Yatsenyuk. Now, the complicating factor here is that these people have representatives in the parliament. Svoboda, this right-wing party whose shock troops were out there on the street, and even Right Sector, have representation in the parliament. So the opposition is right in the parliament itself. But the issue is much larger. The struggle, and it's a civil war in Ukraine, and it goes back in history, is what kind of Ukraine is it to be? Is it to be an ethnically cleansed, pure, only Ukrainian-speaking, ethnically Ukraine, which is intolerant of everybody else who lives in Ukraine, which, by the way, includes dozens of very substantial minorities, not only ethnic Russians? Or is it going to be what Europe says it seeks, a tolerant, multi-ethnic, democratic Ukrainian state? Now, that's what's at stake in these protests on the square outside Parliament. It ramifies to American policy, because American policy has been for 18 months that we are supporting a government that came to power illegally, but nonetheless as a kind of democratic revolution, according to Washington, and ousted the elected president of Ukraine. We are supporting a democratic Ukraine that will be inclusive. The problem is that this government came to power with the muscle of the very people who are now protesting it. There was a lot of violence on this square 18 months ago. Now, people have died, but more than 100 died back in February 2014. Originally, it was said that they were killed by snipers deployed by the president who was deposed. But all the evidence that has now emerged suggests that these were Right Sector snipers who did the killing of the 100 or 110. And now this Right Sector organization and its allies are back on the square and again being violent. So arguably, we're seeing the beginning of the end of Washington's project there. This simply doesn't track with Washington's rhetoric. Bear in mind, as we say this, powerful forces in Washington are demanding that Obama send $3 billion of lethal equipment to the Kiev government. Some of these people, Senator McCain, for example, to a certain extent, Vice President Biden, say, we are all Ukrainians today. But which Ukrainians are we? Are we the Ukrainians, and there are these in the parliament, who really do want to become a European country?
I want to press.
Or are we the Ukrainians who threw the hand grenades into a crowd of people yesterday?
I want to press you on this, Steve, because of that phone call between the Vice President and Mr. Poroshenko within these last days. This is Professor Stephen F. Cohen, New York University, Princeton University, Russian History Emeritus. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Professor Cohen is here, and the violence in Kiev, three now reported dead, 140 in hospital, and the Kiev police are reporting that they have 18 people in custody of Svoboda's paramilitary wing. They're accusing of firing the grenade that led to some of the injuries, not all, because there was hand-to-hand combat. The dueling headlines, we have one from a pro-Moscow daily, Sagodnya, the Constitution blown to pieces. We also have one from a pro-Kiev daily, Ukraina Moloda, Young Ukraine, bloody amendments. We have everybody standing back saying, let's calm down, let's talk about this. Surprisingly, we have ceasefire or near to on the Donbass frontier, where some very major weapon systems and a lot of very sophisticated preparations for either offense or defense are standing down. And then we have violence in Kiev outside the parliament while they're debating amendments that would move the Minsk II story. But Steve, I want to come back to that phone call between Vice President Biden and President Poroshenko. That looks to me, if we follow the way you have identified this over the many months, that looks to be what's left of the war party. And Merkel and Hollande and Putin on the phone call almost simultaneously, that looks to be the war party. Europe wants this settled. Europe needs Russia's business. Russia needs everything to calm down because of the price of oil. All worldwide oil-rich economies are struggling right now. Canada just went into the recession, for heaven's sake. So how's Russia feeling on this? So the war party, Steve, what's in it for Vice President Biden to puff Poroshenko up when Poroshenko doesn't even have control of his own square?
Of the influential American politicians with considerable power today, two have been at the forefront of this Ukrainian project, and that's Vice President Biden, whom, so far as we know, has been tasked by Obama from the beginning to oversee the project. Biden himself has said repeatedly that he speaks on the phone 3 or 4 times a week with the leaders of Ukraine. And we know that the American ambassador in Kiev, John Piatt, is deeply involved in governmental decisions. So there's a kind of vertical line that's running through from the ambassador through American State Department into Biden's office. The other figure, of course, is Senator John McCain. Both McCain and Biden got involved in this let's expand NATO across Russia's red lines, first Georgia, that failed, and now Ukraine, for more than a decade. One understands how McCain got into this. This is what he does. He's an embattled man. He has a loathing for Russia, for Putin in particular. And in a certain way, despite his own tragic biography, he's eager for war in many places. Biden's harder to explain. I don't know how he became the point man for the political administration on these ventures, but he has. And now, if he runs for president, the Ukrainian project, for better or worse, will be his to defend. But he is the guy now. Where Obama is, I don't know. One other thing, John. The ceasefire today that's being reported as holding September 1 is, of course, a good thing. It means people are not dying. But I will be surprised if it holds, and here's why. There are two armies fighting on behalf of Kiev. One is the regular army, which, let me float a generalization, can't fight, won't fight, and doesn't want to fight. It's a bunch of draftees who didn't want to be drafted, and there are a lot of defection across the border to Russia. The bulk of the fighting is being done by these battalions, these armed brigades, and their representatives were there yesterday, bringing violence against the parliament. And therefore, all it takes is one word from, let's say, Dmitry Yarosh, the political leader of Right Sector, to his battalion in the east to open fire. And they will. And the ceasefire will be broken. So it's not, if the ceasefire is broken tomorrow, John, it doesn't mean Poroshenko broke it. It just means he cannot defend the ceasefire because he's not in control of the military or political situation. And if you want to know how severe this split is, right in the heart of this movement that came to power 18 months ago, the people in the street are shouting betrayal at the government. Right. And a government official has said that what they did yesterday was not a protest, but a crime, meaning that they intend to put these people on trial. That could blow up this whole Maidan project.
Yeah, Klitschko is quoted as deriding the protesters with vulgar epithets. And Klitschko
was... That surprises. Let's talk about Vladimir Klitschko a moment. Your listeners may remember seeing him box. He retired as the undefeated heavyweight boxing champion of the world. He is a Russian-speaking Ukrainian, but has lived the last 15... He and his brother, who now holds the heavyweight title, he and his brother have lived and fought out of Germany. Both of them speak German, or they did when the crisis began, much better than they speak Ukrainian. They were both German citizens. We know, because you remember the leaked tape, the Newland tape,
right,
back in February, that Merkel wanted Klitschko to be the president. And that's when Newland said, no, Yatsenyuk is our man, and blank, blank, the European. She meant blank, blank, Merkel and her attempt to make Klitschko the president. So a deal was struck, and Klitschko is now the mayor of Kiev. But if he spoke harshly of the people in the streets, he's burned his bridges to the ultra movement and perhaps positioned himself, and I speculate, he's not much of a politician. And I think in some ways he's a very decent man, but he's a celebrity figure as well. He may now be the backup if Poroshenko goes down. One other point. Yatsenyuk, the prime minister, The one Newland said, he's our man. He's America's man.
He's very well spoken, has been much in America, has visited major think tanks, and presents himself as a representative of transparent government.
That's right. And he has especially longstanding ties with the International Monetary Fund and with George Soros, who's a big backer of this government. But here's the breaking news. In the most recent poll in Ukraine, his party, which had 23 to 25% back during the presidential elections, the parliamentary elections, has fallen to 3%. And that is so bad that Yatsenyuk said that his party will not run in the local elections due in October. In plain language, he no longer has a political electoral party. It's dissolved under the austerity measures that he is the face of there, and which means that America's guy and the IMF's guy in Kiev no longer has a political party. Now, he may join Poroshenko's party, but the point is he is no longer an independent political force as he was a year ago, let's say.
Steve, I want to contribute questions because I don't have answers to this, but in looking at the formula we're seeing right now, Poroshenko is standing with the maximalist position, is what I'm told. He's looking for American intervention. Right. He wants Uncle Sam on Maidan. He wants the guarantees that the U.S. Congress can provide, not just the military, but the economic guarantees, which means a total bailout of Ukraine. Not the EU to bail out, the U.S. to bail out. That's the maximalist position. I do not believe at this point that's realistic, but there's no other way to interpret what's going on right now. Germany and France and Russia are imploring Poroshenko to obey the Minsk II agreements, and he is not. And so, therefore, whatever protest is going on in the square is not against him. It's against the whole idea of Minsk II. It's to reverse all...
That's absolutely correct. These are protests against a negotiated settlement. Forget the word Minsk. Any negotiation of the Ukrainian Civil War that would make concessions to the Eastern Territories in order to keep them in constitutional concessions, to keep them in Ukraine, that approach is totally rejected by these ultra-nationalist forces. Totally. They regard it as betrayal.
And therefore, Poroshenko is in between forces he can't control, but he's cooperating by talking to the vice president and leaving open the possibility of an American intervention. Otherwise, he would have made the deal in Berlin when he was there a week ago. This ceasefire would be holding right now, and we'd be moving towards resolution, special status in the vote.
I guess I disagree with you to this extent, and I've said this before. I think Poroshenko is so weak. I don't mean he's irresolute, that he doesn't have will, but he lacks the political power to implement the Minsk Accords, to go ahead and grant this special status to Donbass, because he has no real political base in Kiev, and that these ultras, though they didn't do all that well electorally, have weapons, have battalions, have an increasing number of young people, and their public support is growing because of the austerity measures. People are becoming resentful that they can't pay their gas bills, they can't feed their families, winter's coming, where's the heat going to come from? I don't see Poroshenko as a warfare personality. I said before, he's not a war maker, he's a candy maker, he's a candy man. That's his business, making candy. But he's caught between forces he can't control. So I don't doubt, and I'm sure Merkel and Hollande, when they called him to Berlin, understand this.
I understand they talked tough to him, Steve. They were not polite.
He said, okay, I'm going to go home and do my best.
Right.
And he got home, and 3,000 to 5,000 people were standing on a square saying, we'll hang you from a flagpole if you do what Merkel
and
told
what,
you,
what
told
is the vice do. What did the vice president say to him? He said, we support you, but what the maximalist position wants is all guns. Right. They want guns, Steve. They want major guns. They want the U.S. flag on Maidan.
All right, here's the dark possible underside. I cannot prove it. I can't produce the evidence. But there's a certain logic in Washington that suggests that a very powerful group in Washington wants a new assault on Donbass by Poroshenko, one substantial enough to threaten the rebels so that Putin will enter the war. We talk about a Russian invasion, but it hasn't been much. There is no evidence of regular Russian troops fighting there. They're training. There are Russians there, but who could tell a Russian from a Ukrainian in the Donbass? They're all native Russian speakers. Many are intermarried. They have dual citizenship. But I mean a real Russian invasion, which we would recognize. Guys would jump out of airplanes. They'd shut down the communications of Kiev. There is a group in Washington, I fear, that wants that to happen, that wants to provoke Putin into entering this war so that the United States and NATO can enter big time. And I can tell you, though I don't know about the Washington people who are behind this, that in Moscow, this is widely believed to be the case at the highest levels, and that Putin himself has this view, that they're trying to drag him into this war full scale. That's
right.
What they want.
Where we stand.
That would explain why, if you ask, and if it is Biden, that Biden and others in Washington keep telling Poroshenko, man up, mobilize, march.
Miracle. They're waiting for a miracle. We're going to turn to the NATO crisis when we come back, because the NATO crisis is a long-range problem for the rest of us, whether Kiev settles its matters or not. I'm speaking with Professor Stephen F. Cohen, New York University, Princeton University, Russian History Emeritus. I'm John Batchelor. Later in the program, Selena Zito of the Pittsburgh Tribune Review discusses the significance of Vice President Joe Biden marching in the Pittsburgh Labor Day Parade. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Steve Cohen's here, and we're moving away from the Black Sea Basin. We're even moving away from the Baltic Sea Basin, where there is an exercise planned by NATO come October, a very large exercise across the north of Europe to prepare for the eventuality of a hybrid war in the Baltic states. I don't know. There are many scenarios. I want to move to the new ice curtain. This is a major journalistic exercise in what-ifs in the 21st century. What if Vladimir Putin continues his aggression to grab off the Arctic Circle resources, the ability to navigate across the oceans that are opening up with climate change, the ability to plumb the oil and the mineral wealth that we know are along the shelves, the Russian shelf and the Northern Europe shelf and the Canadian shelf? What if this is the new ice curtain, and it's dropping, and Russia's way out front because of the number of icebreakers it has, and because I mentioned that Russia's already moved military forces, army brigades, to a military base 30 miles from the Finnish border? This is all reported in the New York Times within these last days. So we'd have to say that there are people in Washington, the U.S. Navy particularly, who are watching this, Steve. Is this now the way NATO is going to move, having lost its fantasy of a war on the Polish-Russian frontier? They're going to move to, what is this? You'd have to say Ice Station Zebra. This is the original Rock Hudson fantasy of the Cold War. Come back with Vladimir Putin in the role of the villain.
When I read the New York Times front page story, I think it was Sunday, August 30th, the writer begins the story by saying, some already call it a new Cold War and it's spreading to the Arctic. He was being fed this point of view by military people in the United States who are alarmed that Russia is so far ahead, so to speak, because it's been building icebreakers going back to the 30s. It's rescued, by the way, a lot of non-Russian ships. Some people in the story actually say Russia's been quite virtuous in opening navigational lines and saving people and opening communications there. But let's be clear what the issue is. You have five or six countries that have rights to the mineral resources of the Arctic. It's said that about 40% of the globe's mineral resources, not only oil and gas, others, precious resources, natural resources, are there in the Arctic. And with global warming, the shipping lanes and the drilling possibilities are developing and will continue to develop. A country has a kind of statistical way of laying legal claim. There are treaties govern this. How far does your continental shelf extend into the Arctic waters? The dispute involving Russia involves about 100 square miles. everybody agrees, I maybe have my numbers a little off, that Russia has something like 385 square miles, and Russia says, no, we have 485. But that is open to a process of adjudication, because other countries lay claim also, and everybody's agreed to let some neutral body decide this. There's been no evidence of Russian aggression. There's been no evidence of Russian breaking the rules. It's just that Russia's ahead because they've plied the Arctic going back into the 1930s. It would be like saying that there are more surfboards in the United States than there are in Russia. I mean, we're a surfing nation, and Russia doesn't surf because it doesn't have those kind of waves.
Steve, there's a Russian flag on a titanium flag at the bottom of the Arctic seabed, and that photograph appears in the paper. So if you're reading this quickly, what you think is that Russia's already claimed the North Pole.
Yeah, but it's a bogus story. It's a reckless story. It's playing on the Cold War that already exists. And by the way, John, it falls into the category of here we go again. You'll remember that when the Soviet Union ended and all these oil riches in the former Soviet territories were opening up, we discussed this a long time ago, and the discussion of pipelines, there was a proposal that there shouldn't be a competition, that the world needed energy, and there should be a Western Russian Kazakh cooperative pipelines. But all Russian offers of cooperation were rejected, for whatever reason, by the West. And now we have a pipeline war that's been going on for a decade or more. Same thing with the Arctic. If there was ever a place, in addition to space, which is the other virgin territory at risk, where the West, particularly the United States and Russia, should cooperate, it's the Arctic. There is no evidence, because Russia lacks certain resources, that it's against cooperation once the boundaries are determined. But the United States, or at least these people who fed the article to the New York Times, are taking this Cold War approach, which is, oh my God, the Russians are on the march, they put this little symbolic flag down there, we've got to get out there.
But we're so far behind,
John, that this would require something like going to space.
The Obama administration is not taking this lightly, Steve, given all of its busy work in the Middle East. The quote in the New York Times piece, we see the Arctic as a global commons. It's not apparent the Russians see it that same way we do. That is a very diplomatic way of saying, Steve, we're going to contest this. We're going to contest this hard.
John, it's the wrong vision for America, for Russia, and the world. It ought to be the Arctic is going to be exploited, whether we like it or not. It needs to be protected, and there has to be a concert of nations working together. And it's fully attainable if there's a political will. It's just that this new Cold War has destroyed any political will in Washington for cooperation with Russia.
The ice curtain droppeth. Steve Cohen, Professor Stephen F. Cohen, New York University, Princeton University, Russian History Emeritus. I'm John Batchelor. Ukraine crisis to be continued. This is the John Batchelor Show.